It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. A major initiative to establish Pittsburgh as a city of the future. The city's bike share program is ready to roll and patching those potholes. Mayor Bill Peduto is here to address all this and more during his monthly visit to the program. Mayor Peduto, good to have you with us. Welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. Good to be here.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at essspgh. Again, if you have a question or comment for Mayor Peduto, the number is 412-246-2002. Mayor Peduto, the P4 People, Planet, Place, and Performance is being unveiled tomorrow at an international summit in Pittsburgh that you are hosting. Explain what this is and what it's focusing on.
Well, P4 brings together about 25 world leaders on the thought of building a 21st century city, together with about 200 Pittsburghers. And the goal is to understand that we're going to see for the first time in over 40 years growth. We've been very, very good at managing decline, but now we're going to grow. And there's something very special about Pittsburgh that makes it Pittsburgh. And even during the 80s when we were going through a depression, people still loved the city. And it goes beyond sports teams. There's something really unique about Pittsburgh. So as we grow, we don't want to ruin it. And I always use the adage, we don't want to put too much soup or salt in the soup. We want to be able to make sure that the growth enhances what we already have. And then we want to take it one step further. We want to be able to hit standards that exceed world standards or at least match them in making Pittsburgh a world leader once again on a global scale. So what does that mean? That means that sustainability standards have gone way beyond LEED buildings. It has gone way beyond Pittsburgh being a leader in green buildings 20 years ago and how those issues of sustainability are being addressed in the world, and in particular in the region of the Nordic countries, of Denmark, of Sweden, and having world experts come in to tell us how that happens. It talks about people. You know, we went through decades of the old industry before the workers had the opportunity to join the middle class. We went through struggles in order to be able to do it. What are the examples today of how a new economy can emerge that also gives people the opportunity to be a part of it and doesn't create basically two classes within the city? It looks at place. The unique things that make a city, the way that you can look at New Orleans and it feels like New Orleans, the way that you can see Paris and see it is Paris. What is it about it, and how can you use public space in order to really create identity? And then finally, performance. Because if you don't have a metric to measure this, if you're not making sure that there are ways that all of these things combine through technology and innovation, then basically it's not happening in a way that is really making sure that you're doing more than having a conference. So P4 is an international conference being hosted by the Heinz Endowments. It was a conversation started by Andre Heinz about his commitment to this city and a partnership now with the city of Pittsburgh to bring all these people from around the world to work with us as we start to see this next Pittsburgh.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation. Let's go to Ann in Friendship, who would like to visit with Mayor Peduto with us here on Essential Pittsburgh. Hi, Ann. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, thank you.
That's good. Hello. I'm calling about concerns about low and moderate income people, long-time residents being able to remain in the city, particularly in the East End. What kind of range of options are you looking at? Things like anti-speculation or anti-flipping legislation, as well as long-term efforts to preserve and increase the amount of affordable housing?
Well, there's two tracks right now, and there's on both sides, we are way, way under what the capacity is. On affordable housing, we have a need for about 7,000 units of housing in the city. And at the same time, for high-end housing, which is what paves our streets, which is what hires our police officers, which is what provides services, we need 5,000 more units of high-end housing in the city as well. It's not choosing one or the other. It's making sure that you have a city that has both, because if all you have is affordable housing, then you don't have a tax base. So what we need to do and what we're looking at is providing opportunities, especially in areas where we have vacant and blighted housing, instead of tearing them down and building apartment buildings, working with nonprofit organizations to restore them, using it as a workforce initiative as well, and to create affordable housing options. The nice thing about this is that we're way behind the times. In cities like Los Angeles is a bad example because it's so sprawling, but San Francisco is a good example. Boston is a good example. Even New York. They didn't make the plans first, and now what you see is with the influx of people moving back into cities, people have been pushed out. So we have the opportunity to make the plans to be able to have a certain amount. Looking at anti-flipping legislation or I can't remember what the term was used for the other, is not something that we're looking at right now. We our goal is to create opportunities for affordable housing that allow people to have home ownership so that when the neighborhood's value goes up, you have the opportunity to stay. And I can tell you this, that the ideas of gentrification are real, but gentrification doesn't occur when you develop a parking lot. It occurs when you start to look at areas where people live and make it so that they can no longer afford to live there. That's why we have to work on home ownership. But the disinvestment in community has driven far more people out of neighborhoods in Pittsburgh than investment.
And thank you for the call. 412-246-2002 if you have a question or comment from the mayor or for the mayor. We were talking earlier about what the P4 is exactly and how Pittsburgh can be a city of the future. Are we talking about Pittsburgh as – or if we are talking about Pittsburgh as setting the example, why Pittsburgh? And I know you've talked about the attributes of the city and all the things that it has going for it, but why Pittsburgh more so than Boston, San Francisco, or say Denver, Minneapolis? I know that you've identified Boston and San Francisco as two areas that kind of went ahead with plans to kind of reinvent themselves and create new infrastructure without necessarily taking the needs of the population into consideration. So Pittsburgh has the opportunity to do that. But how else can Pittsburgh be the benchmark or the template for a city of the future?
Boston's been a really good example, but going back to Ann's point, Boston's also had a very serious problem with people not being able to afford to stay in the city. I mean, and they can't afford to cross to the river and go to Cambridge either. I think with Pittsburgh is that since we're starting to see this a couple decades later than others, we can learn from those mistakes. The other issue is scalability. I just left a meeting with the former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, Graham Richards, legendary mayor. Basically brought in all these creative standards of how they were able to provide services and really was lauded as a leading light in urban government and urban reform, and now leads an initiative on renewable energy on a global basis, but in particular North America. He loves Pittsburgh, and he sees the potential that's here because of not only is it small enough to get things done, but because we have large institutions that can become partners in nonprofit and in different ways. If you go back to 1945 and look at what David Lawrence did and created a whole new model, it was with the corporate community. And there was a corporate mission which was very different than corporate missions today. They didn't push for lower taxes or free parking. They wanted to clean our air and to clean the water, and that's how the Allegheny Conference was formed. Today, those same initiatives are being pushed from a civic initiative. It's coming out of the universities, out of the foundations. And Pittsburgh has the ability now with so much land to be able to develop. Areas like 200 acres in Hazelwood that were a former industrial site where nobody has to be pushed out in order to do it. And to be able to look and say, hey, we were able to create housing here for the mill workers. Can we create housing for the next generation of workers that will be a part of a middle class? Can we create jobs that not only are part of a new economy for some, but for all? I mean, these are the challenges that P4 tries to address, how they can be sustainable, how it can affect people, how it has the ability to enhance place and how we measure it. Those are the components. and it's small enough that we can do it here, and it's large enough that the world will take notice.
Who are some of the presenters at the summit?
I knew you were going to ask that, and I had it on my phone, and my phone went dark. Okay. It's broken up into those four sections. So with people, one of the leading experts in this country on issues of equity, Angela Glover Blackwell from PolicyLink is going to be here. You know, I had the opportunity to meet with her and was a part of a PolicyLink discussion when I was a member of council. They push the envelope on ideas, but they get results. It's not just putting them out there, but actually seeing it, and then they measure it in cities as well. Greg Watson from the Shoemaker Center for New Economics, from Siemens, Jürgen Siebel, Mark Hatch, the CEO of TechShop, and how this whole makers movement has the ability to be able to create entrepreneurs from people that never had the chance to before. Gabe Klein from the Fontellus Partners, and that's all going to be moderated by Presley Gillespie from our own neighborhood allies. We have a very strong presence from Nordic countries when it comes to planet, since they have set the standard. From the Stockholm Chamber of Commerce, Maria Ranka. From the city of Malmo, Christer Larsson. From Little Dania, Jesper Nygaard. Grant Oliphant will be a part of it, and Hal Harvey from Energy Innovation, that's going beyond just looking at how well a building can be built, but the energy sources that are a part of it and how it can also be a part of an entire structure. We have Kai-Uwe Bergman, part of BIG, one of the leading architectural firms in the world from Copenhagen, the Rocky Mountain Institute, Jeff Speck, from Speck & Associates, who wrote about walkability of cities and the density that's become one of the bestsellers within the field.
It's quite a roster.
Bruce Katz from the Brookings Institute is coming in to moderate performance and how we get the measurements done. Mayor Andy Burke from the city of Chattanooga, who started Google Fiber, and talking about how we are able to connect with that. Tim Rowe from the Cambridge Innovation Center in pulling together all the tech. It is an all-star lineup if you're a city geek and love this stuff. It's like going to the all-star game.
We're talking with Mayor Bill Peduto here on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Lots of folks that want to talk to the mayor, and we'll get to all of your calls, starting with Andrea in Oakland. Andrea, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi. This is Andrea calling from Oakland.
Yes.
Hello, Mr. Mayor. Calling to find out what the city is going to do to talk with the school board about trying to make sure that everybody is on board with the idea that we might begin to grow again. The school board doesn't project any growth in its property tax revenue for the next 10 years, and it's just weird given how many thousands of new units we're putting into play over the next period of time. So I was just wondering, is there any way that we can make sure that projections get shared?
I think there is, and Andrea, I think it's really good timing, too, and it's going to be a really interesting part of the conversation. I don't think anyone's ever brought this up before. The commission that we created that now has school board members and city council members and community leaders and teachers and everybody else on board that will be meeting on a quarterly basis has taken on one of its major issues, school funding, but it hasn't looked at the other side, which is budgeting, which is interesting. And until you said that, I really didn't think about it. So I'm going to be speaking at a hearing in support of our schools and the need for the state reforms that are being addressed in Harrisburg that the governor has spoken about that would help the schools to be able to get additional funding. But I think that the other side of the conversation is exactly what you're talking about and should be a part of this commission's discussion as well. And we have now a vehicle to be able to do it at a table and with the members of both council and the school board there.
Andrea, thank you for the phone call. Let's go to Joseph on the south side. Joseph, you're on with Mayor Peduto.
I got two questions. How much tax revenue are we going to collect from the development of the Hill District? And do we collect real estate taxes from the baseball park?
The second one's the easy one. No, it's ours. So we get no revenue from PNC Park, Heinz Field, or Consol Energy Center. In fact, the leases that they have that are about 30 years give us about $100,000 a year for the lease. And all the revenue for them, whether it's the pouring rights, the naming rights, the advertising in the stadium, the advertising out of the stadium. They get a pouring right by, you know, giving Pepsi or Coke the right to sell their product, and they get the profit on all the food and drink. That all goes to the teams. What we're left with is we have to pay for the new scoreboards, the new seats, the new lights, any of the upgrades for 30 years, which is going to cost us. There was a 3-2 vote. I still remember it. I used to work for a guy named Dan Cohen on city council, voted against it and said it would be better if we just gave them the stadiums. We'd be able to make more money. On the second one, it's still determining what the total cost of the development will end up being. But we're probably looking at something around $50 million long-term in new tax revenue, not on an annual basis where we get it, but about $50 million that would be developed over the long-term basis on the new development over on the 28 acres in the hill. What's going to be interesting, though, is what will that mean for 5th and Forbes and Center Avenue as it starts to grow towards Oakland?
Thank you, Joseph. Let's go to Kyle in Gibsonia with a question. Kyle, welcome. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing fine today. So over the past 6 months, I've heard rumblings about new hotels in Pittsburgh. Dan Rooney mentioned something about new hotels for potential Super Bowls. And Dr. Samuel Conway, chairman of Anthrocon, has also mentioned that he would like to see more hotels in Pittsburgh in order to grow a more tourism-based economy. And what were your thoughts on that? What's the attitude towards that sort of thinking?
Well, the first thing I thought of when I heard Cal from Gibsonia was Cal Gibson from the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Oh, there you go.
Yes. The second was...
How about that, Kyle?
Yes. The second was that we get inundated with developers both locally and nationally. I don't think we've had any international yet on the hotel side. And we have had developers internationally now coming to Pittsburgh to look to do development in the city. But on the hotel side, I'd like to see some quality hotels. We've got the Residence Inn and the Spring Hill Suites and all the other ones that are part of the downtown. We only have the Fairmont Hotel Monaco on the high end. Four Seasons is now looking in it. If you look at what they did in New Orleans, it's remarkable because they didn't just develop a high-end hotel. They hired all local people. And I'm not talking about local people to build the building. I'm talking about minority-owned businesses to be a floral shop inside. They put an amazing effort to make it to be one of the most inclusive developments, probably the most inclusive hotel development that I've ever seen. And they also built a residential part of it as well, which, again, going back to the tax base, the only two ways we get taxes to keep those schools open and keep those plows moving that snow is property and wages. So I think what you're going to see, Kyle, is much further than just downtown, into the Strip, into Lawrenceville, closer to the Children's Hospital, up into Bloomfield, over into East Liberty, over into Squirrel Hill, into the South Side, over onto the North Shore, hotels popping up.
Couple of issues I wanted to tackle before we let you go in the few minutes we have remaining, Mayor Peduto. Let's talk bike sharing. After nearly 2 years of development and delays, Pittsburgh's bike share program is ready to roll. What is happening with that?
Well, the Highmark Allegheny Health Plan has stepped in, and they took on the major sponsor role. That was what was missing. And what that means is that it's not only paying for the infrastructure of having 50 bike stations and 500 bikes, but when you ride that bike, and let's say you're going from Oakland to downtown, you leave the bike in downtown. You don't have to take it back to Oakland. And somebody at night has to go every night and move them all back. That costs money. You have to have a management program. You have to be able to maintain them. You have to make sure that they're working properly. So they've stepped in, and that will happen. What we are doing is we did heat mapping, it's called, where you find out who rides bikes, where they live, where they go, what the routes are, doing all the data on the amount of traffic in those areas and what the safest ways are. And now we're building out the protected bike lane highway. And that will be over in the next 8 years. I hear people say, no one's on that Penn Avenue bike thing. Why get rid of that? Well, that's like saying, okay, we're going to build a new highway, but all we're going to do is build the exit ramp, and no one's using that exit ramp. Well, we only have one little stretch. So in the next 2 years, you'll be able to get on that, go across the Clemente Bridge into the north side, go up down through downtown, get onto the Mon River Trail, get onto the Allegheny Trail, get up into Oakland. You'll be able to get from Oakland to the north side without having to play dodgeball with cars. And guess what will be along the way? The bike sharing. It will be a part so that if you don't have a car, which over 30% of the people in the city don't have, and those are the people I represent, or over half of the people that work downtown don't take a car to work, you have an opportunity to have some other type of transportation to get where you're going. And it all works into one big system.
Last item, potholes. This is the time of the year when you're dealing with filling those in. And today you're debuting equipment designed for that purpose. What can you tell us about that?
Guy Costa's wacky asphalt plant on wheels machine is coming into the Berg today. The Costa something. I don't know. We got to come up with a name with it. I'm looking
Costa
at
Costa Convertible?
Yeah.
Converting it from a hole to something level?
So this will be the first asphalt plant on wheels in North America. It will not just like plow, go over a pothole, but on nights when we can't get asphalt because the asphalt plant's closed, or on weekends when we can't get asphalt because the asphalt plant's closed, or in the winter when we can't get asphalt because the asphalt plant's closed, we're now going to be able to drive our asphalt plant on wheels down the street instead of putting that cold patch in that all falls apart and leaves those little rocks everywhere. We're going to be able to use nice hot asphalt. You like some hot asphalt? We got hot asphalt.
Sounds perfect.
Kicking asphalt.
Sounds like the solution to a problem that has plagued Pittsburgh for years, and which this time of year is.
There are other
bad
machines like it that scrape up the old stuff, and when testing it, the engineers that we spoke to, the elasticity of the asphalt is lost, and what you end up putting down falls apart within a couple of years using that.
So that stuff that you pick up and it starts rattling around under your car, it's like popcorn going, and you're thinking, what is going on underneath?
It's basically rocks with some little sticky stuff to be able to hold it in place.
This will eliminate that.
Well, at least for the major rows, if we're going to test it. We're going to kick the tires literally on this thing for 4 months. And if it works, we'll go into a longer lease agreement. If it doesn't, we'll go back to the old way, but then we're going to start looking at buying our own asphalt plant, or at least partnering with the county to do it. We just can't keep doing the way that we have been doing and waiting until, you know, tax day before you can actually purchase asphalt, and then knowing that at the end of November you can't get any again. And on the weekends, oh, sorry, even though you got crews out there, can't use any. There's a better way if we have our own.
Kicking some asphalt.
Kicking some asphalt.
Says the mayor. All right. Mayor Peduto making his monthly visit to Essential Pittsburgh. As always, great thanks,
Thank
sir.
Thank you. It's good to see you.
Coming up, who was John Brashear and what was found in the time capsule uncovered from his Northside factory? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In the rural parts of the Southeast Asian nation of Cambodia, liquid cleansing soap is a rare and precious commodity. The United Nations reports that 1 out of 8 Cambodian children dies before the age of 5 due to preventable diseases. Samir Lakhani, a senior environmental studies major at the University of Pittsburgh, saw this problem and proposed an innovative solution: recycling partially used bars of soap left behind by hotel guests. In his own words, Lakhani explains how he came up with the Eco Soap Bank and how it is helping to improve health in rural Cambodia.
I first began going to the country of Cambodia in the summer of 2014, where I was leading a few projects to address food security in the northern region of the country by building fish ponds and some commercial fishery enterprises. And when you first arrive in a Cambodian village, immediately some things are going to stand out. And there's this one scene that I can't rid myself of. It's the scene of a Cambodian village mother who was bathing her newborn child in a concoction of laundry detergent because it was the only widely accessible soap product or cleaning agent made available in this isolated Cambodian village. Not only that, but she also proceeded to wash some of her pots and pans and dishes with that same laundry detergent. That led me to begin researching sanitation in Cambodia, and what I found was gravely concerning. I found that 75% of the rural areas, about 13 million people, live in these rural areas. lack the appropriate soaps for hand washing. And hand washing, I want to be clear, is the single most powerful and effective action anyone can take to keep oneself safe and healthy in the prevention of illnesses such as diarrhea, pneumonia, respiratory illness. The list goes on. And these hygiene-related illnesses are the leading cause of death for children under the age of 5 in Cambodia. So with the simple provision of soap, we can somehow reduce the frequency of illness and restore health to entire Cambodian villages. I began researching international responses to sanitation and international initiatives, and I was curious to find out some soap recycling efforts taking place in the United States and in Hong Kong and other places around the world where dirty bars of soap are being collected from the hotel industry. They are then sanitized and redistributed or shipped to refugee camps or communities around the world that desperately need it. And that process, I thought, could be easily replicated in the country of Cambodia, because Cambodia is home to the Angkor Wat temples that draws the attention of approximately 2 million tourists a year. There are over 300 hotels and guest houses in the northern part of the country to meet that tourist demand. There must be a tremendous amount of soap being thoughtlessly discarded, I thought. If we could somehow collect these gently used, partially used bars of soap, sanitize them, and then redistribute them to the rural isolated communities that need it in order to restore health to these families, we should absolutely do that. And that was the founding story of the Eco Soap Bank. And since then, we have worked in over 25 villages. We are partnered with 10 NGOs, a hospital, a handful of schools, and some government institutions as a vehicle, not only to distribute these life-saving soaps, but additionally to use their programs and their curriculums to change hand washing and hygiene behavior in a country that lacks that sanitation education, because soap itself is not sufficient. It also needs to be supplemented with proper hygiene education. There is an environmental component to the Eco Soap Bank as well, as we're significantly reducing the amount of waste being discarded from the hotel industry. And additionally, we also collect recycled water bottles, and we contain our liquid soaps as we melt the soaps down and we put them in recycled water bottles, because there is no comprehensive recycling system in the entire country. So in that sense, that is also another environmental impact of the Eco Soap Bank. And lastly, there is an economic impact. We wish to eventually start training widowed village women how to start recycling their own soap, either to start their own soap businesses or just to contribute soap to their communities and their schools in an effort to raise sanitation in these areas and regions. And also looking long-term, there is a macroeconomic component as well, where if we somehow unburden hospitals from patients seeking treatment from preventable illnesses, and with basic sanitation and public health being widely accessible to the entire country, the country can itself elevate itself and develop economically and lift itself from the poverty which has stricken so many people in rural Cambodia and which it cannot seem to escape.
That was University of Pittsburgh Environmental Studies major Samir Lakhani explaining how he came up with the Eco Soap Bank and how it is helping to improve health in rural Cambodia. More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. President and CEO of the Heinz History Center, Andy Masick, tells us about John Brashear and the time capsule of items recently uncovered from his Northside factory. But first, each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
Baseball became the national obsession in the decades following the Civil War. Blacks and whites played together until the 1890s, when racism drew a color line through the sport, says Rob Ruck, a professor of sport history at the University of Pittsburgh.
African Americans, when denied the opportunity to play in the major leagues, create their own sporting world on the other side of the racial boundary.
In the midst of a hostile society, African Americans created their own cultural institutions, the Negro National League and Negro American League among them, says Ruck.
During the 1930s, with Cool Papa Bell flying around the base paths, Josh Gibson hitting home runs further than anybody had ever seen hit before. And Satchel Paige telling his fielders to sit down while he walked the bases loaded and struck them out, Pittsburgh became the crossroads of black baseball.
It was one of only a few cities with two Negro League teams, the Pittsburgh Crawfords and the Homestead Grays. The Grays were originally skilled steelworkers from Homestead. The Crawfords were a sandlot team from the Hill that Gus Greenlee, owner of the Crawford Grill, turned into a professional team, says Ruck.
Greenlee resurrected the Negro National League. He based it in Pittsburgh. He built the finest black-owned stadium, Greenlee Field.
7 of the first 11 Negro League players later elected to the National Baseball Hall of Fame played at least part of their career for the Crawfords or for the Grays. When society told African Americans they were lesser, baseball was a means of proving otherwise, says Ruck.
They were not only equal, they were often more than equal. And that psychological impact, I think, is significant.
The leagues and teams weren't created to combat racism, though they did, bit by bit. They were created to play baseball. Really great baseball, says Clarence Bruce, a player for the Grays, in Ruck's documentary, Kings on the Hill, Baseball's Forgotten Men.
When we walked into a town, we walked with our heads held high. We knew we were great ball players. And I think the fans knew it. I think the white fans knew it.
In 1935, the Pittsburgh Crawfords fielded arguably the best baseball team of all time, says Ruck.
A roster of 16, 5 of those 16 men are in the Hall of Fame.
The 1927 Yankees had 6 Hall of Famers, out of 25 men. The Crawfords in 35 were unstoppable, and that year took the Negro World Series championship. Monty Irvin, who played for the Newark Eagles, describes home run hitter and catcher Josh Gibson in Kings on the Hill.
Josh was the most awesome hitter I've ever seen. He was like the black Babe Ruth.
John Gibson is the great-grandson of Josh Gibson, an executive director of the Josh Gibson Foundation, which helps children reach their potential by providing opportunities Josh Gibson didn't have, he says.
My grandfather always felt that education was going to be the key for our youth.
The son of a sharecropper, Josh Gibson moved to Pittsburgh from Buena Vista, Georgia. He grew up playing baseball on the city's sandlots at a time when few other options were open to him, says Gibson.
These guys had to endure a lot of things. You know, he was born at a time where just things were different. But he made the best of it, and he still accomplished a lot.
Like many of the great black baseball players of his time, Gibson never got the chance to play in the major leagues. But they're legends even so, says Ruck.
There's a sense of accomplishment, a sense of self-awareness when you are able to do something or not able to do something. And sport is very unforgiving in that respect. You're only as good as what you're able to do.
There was nothing Pittsburgh's black baseball players couldn't do, except prove society wrong sooner. For 90.5, WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. I'm Margaret J. Krause.
UPMC is proud to support 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Despite a modest upbringing, Pittsburgher John Brashear was one of the leading creators of telescopes and scientific instruments in the world. Recently, a time capsule of items from Brashear was uncovered in the North Side, making front page news in our region. Joining me to talk about that is Andy Masick, president and CEO of the Heinz History Center. Andy Masick, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
It's good to be here.
What should we know about John Brashear?
We should know a lot about John Brashear. In his day, he was very well known. He was one of the fathers of modern astronomy, at least in the United States, was one of the most proficient telescope makers in history. He invented all kinds of processes that are still used today in the manufacture of fine optics and telescopes. And in fact, if it weren't for John Brashear, the great Allegheny Observatory, which is known worldwide for identifying star locations and actually naming stars, their work wouldn't have been possible without the extraordinary telescopes made by John Brashear.
Brashear was working 12-hour days in a Southside rolling mill. When did he find the time to tinker with telescopes and scientific instruments?
Well, you know, you should know first that when he was 9 years old, a boy growing up in Brownsville, he had a chance to look through a telescope. And as soon as he looked through that, he was hooked. And he went to school, grammar school, had 3 years of education. By the time he was 15, his parents thought the kid can do better than working in a saddler's shop or some other manual labor job in Brownsville. So they sent him to Pittsburgh to Duff's Mercantile College to learn to be a bookkeeper because they thought he had book smarts. And he took the course there. He hated it, you know, doing all this bookkeeping. But he learned everything they had to teach them. And then he decided that he needed to go to work and earn a living and got a job as a millwright in one of the iron mills here in Pittsburgh.
And what would they do?
Well, it was a rolling mill. So they'd be rolling iron ingots into sheet goods for making everything from rails to stoves, probably. Well, Brashear was a pattern maker because everyone recognized the cabinet makers and all the skilled craftsmen realized that Brashear had technical skills that they should take advantage of. And they did. And he worked hard, 12 hours a day. But at night, he came home and he worked on telescopes. And he married a young woman, Phoebe Stewart, who shared his love for the stars. And together, they worked on polishing lenses and glass. And this is a very laborious process because a mirror used in a telescope or a lens has to be perfect, perfectly flat or perfectly convex, without any flaws. The polishing was all done by hand using fines or a kind of powder, abrasive powder. And Phoebe did much of this work herself, and they would spend hours polishing and polishing. It could take more than a year to make one lens. One of his early lenses in the 1860s, a 5-inch lens they worked on together. That's a huge lens. Nobody else had done that, certainly not in America. And when they finished it, he was so excited. He took it to her. He dropped it, and it broke. It was the most heartbreaking experience of his life, he said. And yet they dusted themselves off, and they started again. And within a year, they had another lens. And when he got that finished, he wrote Samuel Langley a letter. Now, Langley was the head of the Allegheny Observatory. And here's this kid working in a rolling mill down on the Mon River, and he gets a letter from him, and Brashear tells him about his lens. And Langley, at first, was a little bit dismissive. But then when he realized how much this kid knew and how proficient he was at making lenses, he started to encourage him. And, well, the rest is history.
And like other Pittsburgh industrialists such as George Westinghouse, I understand that John Brashear was a beloved figure in the city.
They called him Uncle John Brashear. Everybody knew the Brashears on the north side. In fact, when people would come to town, there's a story of one physicist came to town, wanted to meet John Brashear, and he gave people the address, and they said, well, I don't know where that address is. Well, I'm not sure where that street is, but who are you looking for? We're looking for John Brashear. Oh, why'd you say so? Uncle John's right up there on the hill. Everybody knew who Uncle John was, and he never had children of his own. He adopted two children, a boy and a girl, and he cared a lot about people, whether it was the kids that he took in or the people of the community that he helped through the Methodist Church or through other associations. In fact, when Henry Clay Frick wanted to give an anonymous donation to help the people of Pittsburgh, he gave it to John Brashear to distribute because he knew that he would know how to do it.
An interesting time capsule from Brashear was recently uncovered by a demolition company. Tell me what happened.
Well, you may have read in the newspaper that there was a catastrophic collapse of the National Register of Historic Places factory that was the Brashear factory on the north side. And it was tragic because this was a building, a brick building, three stories tall, that was recognized nationally as an important landmark. But one wall gave away, collapsed. It was too dangerous for the neighborhood, so the city had to contract with a contractor to demolish the building. And in the process of that demolition, the contractors, the Minifields, found a brass box soldered together with lead solder in the cornerstone of the building. And to their credit, the demolition crew didn't just rip it open or toss it in a dumpster. They carefully opened it and found in it the very objects that John Brashear and some of his workers put in there in 1894 at the time they laid the cornerstone for the Brashear factory. And the thing that's really kind of remarkable about the things that went in there, it's not treasure. There's no gold or silver or diamonds. There's only one piece of glass. It's an unpolished piece of glass that Brashear wrote on, was one of the first pieces of glass in America to be cast and used for lenses. But there were everyday items in there, newspapers and photographs and letters. The letters are especially interesting because when Brashear was putting together this time capsule box, he contacted some of the people in America, the DuPonts and Carnegie and Langley and others, and he said, would you give me a letter that we could put in the time capsule? Because you've been part of this story of astronomy and telescope and industry in America. And so they wrote him letters back, and they all gave him credit for his extraordinary work, the precision of his instruments, the new inventions that enabled others to reach the stars. And it's really very poignant to see these testimonials to Brashear's skill and his dedication.
Andy Masick is president and CEO of the Heinz History Center, talking about John Brashear. Andy Masick, thank you again for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
The pleasure is mine.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the program or would like to revisit a past segment, you can go to our website at WESA.FM. All of our shows and segments are archived there. Until next time, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.